You're listening to a podcast by the United Nations Research Institute for Social Development.
We still have a little more than half an hour to take questions. So I'm sure that so 1, 2, 3, we will take all the questions, and afterwards we will come back to the panel. So please, may I ask you to introduce yourself?
Michael Cañares from the Philippines. I would like to address a question to Karina and Georgina. Karina, in her presentation, mentioned that we need not be very optimistic of SSE organizations to be able to compete with corporations, essentially because the latter externalizes environmental and social responsibilities, and also there are inherent characteristics of SSE organizations that preclude them from actually scaling up. So I would just like to know if, given this argument, does this mean that scaling up is not at all possible in the current neoliberal context? Or does this mean that scaling up is only possible if there is an alternative economic structure in place, which undoubtedly we do not yet have? For Georgina, I would like, you were saying that if impersonal institutions become the rule of the game and the spirit of solidaristic values are not transferred from old participants to newcomers, then scaling up becomes a tremendous challenge and may not be possible, if I got it right as an argument. I would just like to know, if this is the case, then scaling up may not be necessary. Are you arguing for that? Because the loss of identity becomes an inevitable consequence. Then how do we define success then in our advocacy for SSE, if this is the case? And finally, just a very side comment to Mr. Ghosh. I wonder if the fears of Georgina regarding the loss of identity applies to Amul as well. Thank you.
Yes, please.
Thank you very much. My question goes to Professor Gomez. I think the rise of complementary currency is in the early 2000s, and then that is the kind of a period for economic crisis in Argentina. And is there? I wonder whether there is any kind of a relationship between the rise of complementary currency and Argentinian economic crisis. And related to that, another question for Professor Reed. I mean, you know, you just listed up different types of value chains. And I wonder whether, you know, we can have a change between one type to another, depending on internal and external conditions, especially is there any kind of a specific opportunity we can have to move from a bad type of value chain to good type of value chain in the middle of crisis? Thank you.
Yeah, I have. I think the subject is very important, this question of scale. Now, I have a question for Georgina. Don't you think that it is necessary to take in consideration the context? Because it seems that this is an intrinsic problem. Scaling will have this curve that you said. That curve, I think, had to do with the economic crisis, because the corralito and the lack of money made that a lot of people enter into treque because they found a way to get to things. And then they enter with used things, with steel things, so the system went down immediately that the real money appears again. And also that there were two political projects within the network. One that was the one that was centralizing the issue of money that was printed in Chile. It was like euro. It was not possible to falsify it. And the other that was really democratic. Now, the democratic one didn't want all that people to enter because they didn't even know the rules. This is internal, right? And now the second question is, don't you think that you cannot really say that every social movement will have a curve like that? Because that maybe you can say of a reivindicatory movement that is asking for school. One, you have the school, the movement disappear. But the Indian movement, the feminist movement, etc., I think cannot be expected to have that curve. Sorry. Thank you.
Question for Professor Reed. You mentioned something about resistance to the creation of fair trade in gold. Can you elaborate on that a little bit more?
Yeah. Other questions just now? Yeah.
Yes, in all those, Henri de Cazotte from Agence Française de Développement, in many of those international meetings, we speak of scaling up. I wonder if we should invent the idea of pushing for spinning off and staying small. And maybe the future is, thanks to the information technology and the new models of production and the strength of the growth of the global, I would say, middle class and the possibility of having strong development everywhere in all countries, we could look at smaller systems to develop the local markets, and maybe we could then develop a research on the advantages of doing more spinning off when you have and for instance the cooperative in India could transform itself into 10 cooperatives instead of staying a huge master of the development in one area, and maybe then we'll have another model that is also maybe sustainable. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Cécile Molinier, formerly with UNDP. I was going to say pretty much what Henri just said. I think you have all shown very clearly that there is some sort of a trade-off. You know, when an SSE organization gets too big, it kind of loses its soul and its original strength and very strong social connotation. Why aren't we talking more about replication rather than scaling up, and isn't that what, you know, we should be aiming at and pushing for? And if so, I'd be very interested in hearing from the four of you what would be your views on the possibility of having more SSE organizations so that they represent a larger share of a global economy while preserving the original principles. Thank you.
So, if you're okay. Thank you. My name is Elena. I'm a student of anthropology, and I have got one question. We've seen that in Argentina that there were problems linked to scaling up, and at the same time with the fair trade movement, when it grew bigger and bigger, that there were problems to that. So I would like to ask if you think that those initiatives are just they stay linked to their principles when they are kept on a regional level, and that is following subsequently the only possibility, or whether you think that there a global approach or a bigger approach is an opportunity for the SSE approaches and institutions. Thank you.
One more question.
Yeah, Carolina is my name. I'm also a student. I just wanted to ask, like, how to know until which extent a social solidarity initiative should grow, or where is the point to say it should grow until this extent and then become local, or how to know when it reaches a risk to break off?
Leander Binnenwald from the New Economics Foundation in London. Maybe apart from the question of scaling up or spinning off, even if we replicate small systems, there will be an issue about frameworks and the diffusion into other sectors. So I just wanted to maybe ask the panel as a whole or in internal discussions, or maybe Mr. Reed has a suggestion, what institutions, for example, now the UN could actually do to help complementary currencies, for example, to reach a bigger spread, not in scale, but really in numbers of systems that are recognized.
Okay. Okay. So, I would like to ask one more question, because at the beginning I said that this is the second time I've been asked to chair a session on scaling up within 1 week. The last one was in Tunis and then here. And here it's scaling up through the market. So, yeah, this is not natural. So we could, all of them have raised this type of question. And our Indian colleague shows that there is a lot of gap in management literature, and everything push you to go to a greater scale when you are one organization. There is no much literature or no much policies in order to make more and more SSE organizations. And what I would like to hear from the four panelists is whether we can find any reference in literature as far as transaction costs are concerned, either in a big organization or between small organizations which need to be gathered and to talk all together within a sort of national or international network. I'm not sure that it is obvious for policymakers to know about the choice between being in favor of bigger and bigger organizations, and afterwards we have two big organizations, too big to fail, like in the bank sector, or promoting many, many organizations, which could be something, sometimes more difficult. And I would like to hear from you about the cost of communication and information and personal relationship, and how is it possible to take this cost into consideration within a market system which pushed you to externalize all the transaction costs. Maybe we could begin by you, and afterwards you, Mr. Gott.
Okay. I guess the first question I would have is what we mean by scaling up. Because in fair trade, we're not actually scaling up to a large extent the size of small producer organizations. It's a network of small producers. Now, they may have second-tier co-ops and things like this as well. But for the most part, they are still relatively small organizations. It's not that we're developing large organizations, typically of small producers, but they're networked, or they may be in second-tier co-ops. So the question is, in terms of scaling, though, how can they meet demands in the question of transaction costs? So if you are a supplier or a distributor, you probably don't want to deal with 60, 70, 80, 90, 100 organizations if you can deal with one or two. And if you're dealing with large estates, you can do that. And so there are huge cost differentials, which is why large corporations, which are not committed to social and solidarity economy principles, will move towards estates. So when you bring estate production in, there's competition there under different terms. And so this is a concern that small producers have, is that they get squeezed out of their own market that they created, a social and solidarity economy market, right? Now, the other side of scale, though, is not so much scale, but how you move up the value chain. And that's what they also want to do. They want to get more into processing and things like that. You can do that in a social and solidarity value chain because the people at the top, their whole purpose in being involved is to drive value down to the bottom. And so they will encourage that. But if you're dealing with corporations, that's the last thing they want to happen because you're taking value added away from them. So that's another issue. So getting back to the question then related to when is it too big and can you participate in different value chains or transfer from one to the other, most small producers probably participate in two, maybe even three or four different types of value chains, because they can't sell all their fair trade coffee as fair trade typically, because the market's not there. So they might sell some to small cooperative retailers, they might sell some to large supermarkets, they sell most of it probably on the regular market. So the problem is, though, in terms of which value chains and can we move from one to the other, those questions really come down to the lack of fair competition. Who gets to make these decisions about, you know, when it's too big, right? And the problem that has historically happened in fair trade is we're getting back to governance issues. There's always trade-offs in fair trade. That was an initial trade-off when you want to access these large distributors. There's going to be trade-offs between how much you have your social and solidarity values and how much you can sell. And you want to do both. The question is, who gets to make those decisions? And those decisions were not made by small producers initially. Somebody else opened up the gates that allowed large estates in. They opened up the gates to different markets like gold. And the small producers who take the risks don't get to make the decisions, right? And why they're upset about gold, there may be good reasons and less good reasons, but artisanal gold is not a very sustainable industry, many people would say. On a more negative note, people would say small producers just want to protect their brand. That's why they're against domestic production or domestic fair trade, especially in the north, because they wanted limited agricultural products in the south. So there's different understandings of that.
Professor, Mr. Ghosh, I've heard that some Indian people call Indian democracy a functional anarchy. Is it? You can learn us.
I'm not going to make a politically incorrect statement in the United Nations. but Indian history is very complex. It differs from one state to another, and there is huge differences in levels of democracy. So it's almost impossible for someone to be able to summarize that kind of complexity in a few minutes. So I'll abstain. Amul, yes. There was this question about possibility of loss of identity as a result of extension of size, as a result of, you know, increase in the size of Amul. And having done my field work in Amul, I'm of the opinion that loss of identity is, the possibility is very real, actually. It is very real because, right now, the India is, more and more, India is leaning towards these, the neoclassical values of liberalization and globalization, and they're going full steam ahead with it. And that's a bit of a cause for concern. A lot of big multinationals are already in India, and they're eyeing the Indian market because, milk constitutes a very important part of the Indian diet. So having said that, there is this very real possibility of multinationals coming in and, competing with Amul, and the possibility that they might want to lure away some of the member farmers of Amul by maybe in the short term, giving them higher prices. There is that possibility of loss of identity. At the same time, I want to remind you that so far as size is concerned, I don't necessarily think that scaling up is really such a bad word. we should guard against popular sort of conceptions that one is good and the other is bad. Reality is much more complex, I think, than that. So I think it really depends in the sense that you could actually scale up an organization in a federated way, and by doing so, you can make sure that the organization at the village level remains small. So you could have multiple organizations, and I heard someone mention replication, and that is exactly what Amul has done. Even though it has scaled up through replication. And it has replicated the Amul model at the lowest level, that is, and I should say highest level, not the lowest level, because the farmers come first. So the village, they have replicated the model at the level of the village cooperative society. So now there are 850 or 900 village cooperative societies within the district of Kheda. Now, if we go to another district, which is Mehsana, and yet another district, Surat, and another district, Baroda, they've done the same thing. They've replicated, and they've gone down to the village level, and that is how they've replicated. So basically, even though they've grown large overall, to the outsider, Amul looks large, but for the farmer, it's still small because he's dealing with people within his village. And usually, the average number of members within a village is around 100, 150. And 150 is not that large for a country size of India. So I think we need to guard against these popular notions that scaling up is always bad. I don't think it is. It depends on how you manage the scaling up process, whether you do it through, you know, a federated structure. How to know what is the optimal scale to which you can grow? I really think it's a very tricky question. Again, it depends on the circumstances. For a commodity market like milk, it really depends, because in commodity market, there is this need for economies of scale and later on economies of scope to capture more value added. So I think it really depends. If it's a commodity market, you do need skills, because if you're very small, you cannot compete with big multinationals. So scale is not always bad. So far as transaction cost is concerned, I think it has a direct bearing on cooperatives, because in the case of Amul, at least, in my experience, one of the main reasons they integrated vertically, which is what I mean by that, is that they basically went on to become an organization that would also not just process milk, but also make and manufacture milk products. So effectively, by vertically integrating themselves into a manufacturing organization, they were reducing transaction costs. And at the same time, I think transaction costs have a bearing on autonomy and self-determination. So if you want to capture value added for your farmer members, and if you want to do it by yourself, then, you know, basically what you're doing is you're having a vertical organization. And by having a vertical organization, I think Williamson says that will reduce transaction cost. So does that partly answer your question?
Well, I think there are lots of common aspects. So, Georgina. Okay.
Okay, let's see what I can do. I have 9 questions. Our Filipino colleague, I can't remember your name. What I meant to say is something a little bit different. What I said was you can grow to some up to some point by third-party referral and replication of trust in this way. But after that limit, you enter a new game in which scaling up depends on creating institutions, rules, and you can formalize and cement your rules and your agreements in written regulations or norms or whatever you want to call it. So I'm not saying it's not possible to scale up. I'm saying at some point the scaling up enters this different game of setting your values into institutions, into rules, which become impersonal, and then we can ask ourselves if this is still a social and solidarity economy initiative or something else. And my point is that there are also some challenges of whether people, the initiators, the members of these SSEs, would want to enter this different game, because then they will start competing with different sorts of animals, capitalist enterprises, and so on. So my answer to your question is it's pretty much a matter of choice. The point is that for SSEs to be able to make that choice, they need to make an informed decision, and we do not know enough of this problem of scaling up at the moment to be able to make this informed decision. How do we measure success? Not everybody would agree with you that size is a sign of success. And actually, like I said, there was quite a variety of initiatives within the Trueque. Some of them were very local, and the last thing they wanted was to grow and to coordinate with others. They were very happy being small, manageable, local, and simple. So this is what some people want. I mean, that's why I'm saying it's a little bit a matter of choice. Perhaps the economic impact is very small, but they have empowerment, they have a chance to leave the home, to talk to other people, to share, to become community leaders, and this is also very important. We shouldn't undermine it just because it's small. Certainly not. The relationship between the Argentine crisis and the RT. Can we go back to the chart? Yeah, I think it's slide 8 or something. Yes, that one. Yeah, yes, exactly. Yes, you are right. Of course, these grew a lot as a result of the crisis, but it's not to view the Trueque as a child of the crisis is it's very partial. It's not really like that for several reasons. This period, the first period of growth, happened when the economy was not necessarily doing so badly. And some people would say, no, if you need a period of relative economic stability because then you have more things to sell, then you can do more trade. So they would argue that these kind of schemes work better when the unemployment or the crisis, whatever, is limited. Otherwise, it becomes being an economy for and by the poor, which is what, indeed, as Corazza said, in this period of bubble, it is what it turned out to be. And by the way, the demise started before the economic recovery, so then you have another contradiction. So yes, you are right, this is very much related to the crisis, but it's not purely a child of the crisis. I will manage, but this is an important point. 2003, 4, 5, the Argentine economy was recovering at rates of 4, 8, 9, 10% growth of the GDP, and the people were still going to the Trueque. So, again, it's more complex than that. Of course, as Corazza mentioned, there's a limit to what I can say in 15 minutes. Clearly, the context was very, very, very important. I can't emphasize that enough. I'm not saying that all social movements have this bubble kind of shape, but a capitalist enterprise would definitely not have this shape. But some social movements do. So this is the point I wanted to make, that when you see this kind of shape, you say, well, it looks like many social movements which have an instrumental type of participation in which people achieve what they wanted and then they go home. There were two political projects. I think there were, I don't know, N political projects, because I kept on talking to different people and they kept on having different and different ideas of what they wanted. Spin-offs or one big scale, upscale and very large. Redes in Spanish means network, and actually what they were is very small schemes articulated. Some of these schemes were much bigger. Others were absolutely huge, but they tried both, and there were similar problems in both of them, because at some point, if you want to make a network of networks, there is some sort of articulation needed or some organization or some structure, and this is the big challenge. And I'm sorry I cannot answer the rest. What's the limit? What some people said is the limit is how many faces I can remember. So they situate the number at somewhere under 100, close to 100 and near and under it. And would I mean, could the UN, for example, do something to scale up CCS? Yes, of course, Leander, you're inviting me to start advocating. Sure, but one, for instance, I can think of something very simple. We have no clue how many complementary and community currency schemes are out there in the world. Some people say 1,000, others say a few hundred, others say 5,000. We really don't know. And I think this is a gap on which if any generous organization wants to help us create a database, just to start knowing what this is about, understanding better what this is about, I would be the first one to go and shake hands and be grateful, like you probably. Well, the NEF has a chance to do something there, if you want. Yeah, thanks.
First thing is, I've been working on a crowdsourced database of local currencies, so we should talk about this. The question directed to me, I think, was about, if I'm not very optimistic, can we actually scale up in the current model? I think the general answer is with difficulty, but it's nonetheless not a lost cause. And this is going to take several, different entry points in order to scale up or to replicate. The first one being, I think, a kind of a change in consumption patterns that happen in the global north. And obviously, we've already seen this with fair trade. You know, it is true that there is a growing awareness of the environmental and social costs of consumption. And I think we could, in time, envisage customers actually also caring about questions of ownership and how goods were produced and the extent to which they contribute to local economic development as well. So there might be kind of a consumer pull in favour of SSE organisations. I also think as more and more SSE organisations are put in place, and as I was saying, we already know this is happening in the UK and in the US, there'll really be increased interest, I think, from policymakers who are basically kind of desperate for success stories at the moment. And I could see this kind of, you know, people latching on to these success stories and claiming them as their own, thereby creating a more favorable policy framework for the further scaling and replication. As the question of whether we want replication rather than scale, yes, probably. But then the question is, you know, why aren't there thousands of these organizations? We know they work so well. I mentioned the model in Cleveland. It sounds perfect. Why aren't they springing up all over the place? And here, of course, we need to start really thinking through the barriers to replication. It's actually a really big job getting an SSE organization off the ground. Can we really rely on all these local heroes that Georgina mentioned as well? And this kind of ties into the difficulty of kind of co-production processes that were mentioned this morning. The question of optimal scale, this is a very interesting one, because I would say the optimal scale has been reached and then is exceeded once the unique internal governing characteristics of SSE organizations have been lost, namely if members no longer participate, if the kind of democratic participation is no longer there. At the same time, we have an example in the UK of a very large worker-owned cooperative called Waitrose. I believe they have about 80,000 worker owners. Don't quote me, you'll have to Google it, but it's a very large worker-owned cooperative. The worker owners are very involved, but there's a wider question: is this an SSE organisation? Because basically, it's done this kind of cost externalisation I mentioned in my presentation, and its environmental performance overall is actually comparable to more mainstream organisations. How will we know if we've been successful with SSE organisations? I think we'll know if we end up with more of a hybrid economic system where appropriate, SSE organisations will be providing goods and services that are currently provided by other types of organisations. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for all. It's very complicated to summarise what has been said for two hours, but I would like to make just two or three comments, very short. First of all, I think we all agree there are no limits to social and solidarity economy as far as these organizations and their key identity factors are promoted as development tools. Secondly, I think we all agree that they must have favorable ecosystems which they use to be in accordance with their identity and to with their factor of development. The third and maybe the last one point for me would be the idea of biodiversity, because as every time we ask the question of the optimal size, optimal scale, or whatever, we answer, it depends. It depends of what sector, it depends on whether we are talking about milk or cars, carpooling or currencies, and it depends. So my personal view is that as biodiversity is essential in nature, it is also essential in our society's organization and in the different ways of production. And, of course, as far as regulation is concerned, we have to find sort of fair competition in order to protect biodiversity. So I think we should look further within the different competition policies which has been introduced. I don't know how it works in Asia, but in Europe and in the United States, for instance, there's differences between the different type of competition rules as far as protection of small organizations and monopolies are concerned. And maybe it could be a good way to go on protecting some biodiversity, because what we all agree on, I think, is that one size doesn't fit for all. And sometimes we believe that one size fits for all.
Check out our other podcasts available free on the iTunes Store. For more information, go to our website, www.unrhys.org. Thank you for listening.